Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session at the end of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one to ask a question over the phone. Today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Brady Phillips. Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning, and thank you, everyone, for joining this call, where today we'll have no experts discuss key 2017 temperature and precipitation highlights for the U.S., as well as provide updated information for those weather and climate events in the United States that reached the $1 billion threshold in damage and losses for 2017. Again, this call, as well as our other monthly climate calls, are part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to governments, businesses, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. Again, I'm Brady Phillips with NOAA's Office of Communications. I'll be facilitating the call today. So our format will have two short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer. And I encourage all of you listening in to download a copy of the presentation, and you can get that at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. That's B-R-I-E-F-I-N-G-S. Excuse me. Also, today we are live, or some of us, at AMS in Austin, Texas. So when we get to the Q&A session, we'll be bouncing back with some questions, perhaps from the audience here, as well as those on the call. So I'll be working with the operator to bounce back and forth between questions here in the audience and online. Our first presenter today is Jay Crouch, a climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will be the one providing the summary for the U.S. December and the 2017 year in review temperature and precipitation highlights. Jake will be followed by Adam Smith, an applied climatologist, also at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will give us an update to the final tally and damage estimates for the weather and climate disasters, again, that reached that billion-dollar threshold in 2017. Also, sitting on deck here, we have Deke Arndt, chief of our monitoring sections, also at NOAA NCEI, who will be available to answer other questions that may come up during the call. So our first speaker will be Jake Crouch from NOAA. Jake?
Hi, good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to start off speaking to slide number 2 on the slide deck you can download from our website, and this information is also available in the report that was just released. The contiguous U.S. saw its third warmest year in 2017. The temperature averaged across the lower 48 was 2.6 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. Only 2012 and 2016 have been warmer in the 123-year period of record, and this also marks the 21st consecutive year that the lower 48 average temperature has been above the 1901 to 2000 average temperature. The map on the left shows how temperatures broke down during the year. Above average temperatures spanned the nation from coast to coast. We saw record warmth across parts of the Southwest, the Southern Plains, and the Southeast. Arizona, New Mexico, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina each observed their warmest year on record in 2017. We did see some areas of below average temperatures across parts of the interior Northwest in 2017, so not everywhere was warm, but when we do average those temperatures across the entire U.S., it ranked as the third warmest on record. Outside of the contiguous U.S., Alaska saw its seventh warmest year on record. The graphic on the right on the slide shows a time series of contiguous U.S. average temperatures back to 1895, and we can see an increase or an upward trend in contiguous U.S. temperatures, and we can see how the last 21 years have all been above the 20th century average. Moving on to slide number 3 in the slide deck to talk about contiguous U.S. precipitation during 2017. It was the 20th wettest year on record for the lower 48 and the fifth consecutive year that we've been wetter than average. The year started out on a pretty wet note. We had a really wet winter in the west. We had numerous tropical cyclones impact the U.S., increasing the precipitation total, and we saw significantly above average precipitation across the Midwest during much of the year. On the other end of the spectrum, we did have drought conditions in the Northern Plains and parts of the Southwest develop. And the year ended on quite a dry note. December ranked as the 9th driest on record for that particular month. So the really wet start to the year, a really dry end to the year, resulted in the 20th wettest year on record for the U.S. Some significant precipitation events, which Adam will elaborate on a few of these. We did have the catastrophic flooding across Texas and Louisiana associated with Hurricane Harvey. Record-breaking spring flooding in the mid-Mississippi Valley, and a significant precipitation event impacted Missouri and Arkansas and southern Illinois in late April and early May. Many tributaries to the Mississippi River saw record-high gauge levels during this event. We did see the West, particularly California and Nevada, come out of a multi-year drought early in 2017. That was due to significant precipitation in that region early in the year. And as I mentioned, we did have drought conditions, a pretty substantial drought impact the Northern Plains, one of the worst to impact that region in several decades. And that did come about in early summer, so there were significant impacts to agricultural interest in that region. And then we did have the large and destructive wildfires in the West, most notably in California. The really wet winter there allowed vegetation to flourish. And then during the typically dry summer and autumn period, that vegetation dried out, providing ample fuels for wildfires. And it's been a pretty devastating year out west in that respect. And with that, I will pass it off to Adam.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. My name is Adam Smith with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. So looking at slide number 4, picks up on where Jake left off. As we all know, 2017 was a historic year for billion-dollar weather and climate disasters. There were 16 such disasters across the United States in 2017, including 2 inland flood events, 1 freeze event, 8 severe storm events, 3 tropical cyclones, drought, and wildfire. The cumulative impact of these 16 events exceed $300 billion in damage, which is a new U.S. annual record. There were also more than 360 fatalities with these events. For a deeper perspective, this was also the most costly hurricane season on record of $265 billion and the most expensive wildfire season on record with $18 billion, tripling the previous record established in 1991. Also, Hurricane Harvey's Irma and Maria now join Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Katrina in the new top 5 costliest U.S. hurricanes on record. Looking at slide number 5, this chart shows a lot of information. The bars reflect annual billion-dollar disaster events by type. You can see this year, 2017 tied 2011 for 16 events in the bars. The gray lines indicate the annual cost with uncertainty surrounding those costs as that goes from 1980 to present. Also, the black line is the 5-year annual cost line, which we can see increasing in the last decade plus. This time series also shows all 219 separate billion-dollar disasters that affected the United States since 1980, with a cumulative cost exceeding $1.5 trillion. Let's look at slide number 6, which shows how the distribution of these events affect different states. Indeed, we could say that the nation is weather and climate conscious for good reason, as each geographic region faces a set of unique hazards. And I will not go into the detail of these maps, but clearly 2017 underscores what we've seen in the past with regard to better mitigating our risk and an enhanced frequency of weather and climate extremes.
Thank you. That concludes our short presentations. We will now turn to questions from both the audience and online. Operator, before we choose, can you please remind folks online how they can ask a question? And, go ahead.
I apologize. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly when prompt. Your name is required to introduce your question. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll take a few moments for questions to come through. Please stand by.
Okay, and while we're standing by for the phone, I will just put it out to those in the audience first. If you have a question, just raise your hand. And if not, we'll go to the phone first. Andrew.
Hi, I'm Andrew Friedman from Nashville. I have a question about the rising frequency of billion-dollar events. because there's been some debate in the literature and elsewhere over the parsing out the role between increased exposure to the infrastructure as well as what we expect to be happening, what we already see happening with some extreme events related to climate change. So how do you parse that out? I see a climate.gov post on that, but I'm curious as to what you think.
Yeah, so this is...
Can you just for I'm not sure if the folks on the call heard it, can you just briefly reframe the question?
The question was about parsing out the this is DGARN, by the way, parsing out the relative role of basically the climate signal versus the economic signal, the development and assets. And we don't, that's a great question, and that's also a question that's on the minds of scientists and the folks that work in the field of attribution science really do dive into this. I think one of the beauties of the product that Adam's put together is it kind of tries to meet us where we are. It is a combination of what we see increases in some of the hazards from the physical climate standpoint, particularly those related to flooding, heat, to some extent, storm surge, but also what we have, where we put it, how valuable that stuff is. And Adam's product just blends those two information, kind of meet where we are, and then the attribution, the parsing out, really is a sophisticated kind of retrospective look that the broader field of attribution science lists. So we don't attempt to do that. We really just want to quantify what the nation is experiencing by combining our data sets with those around the world.
One more question from here in the audience.
Yeah, Doyle Hayes from USA Today. Can you repeat again the total cost of the hurricanes for this season?
Yes. The question was, what was the total cost of the hurricanes in the United States and its territories were affected by the season? The total cost was $306.2 billion, which broke the previous record of $215 billion set in 2005.
Was that hurricanes or all disasters?
That was all.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. The hurricane record was 265. All disasters was 306.2. My mistake.
Follow up. Does that include like disasters that didn't reach the $1 billion threshold, or that doesn't include that?
No. So the type of events that certainly we adjust for inflation backwards in time for sub-billion-dollar events. So you would see that severe local storm events, hail, tornadoes, straight line wind damage. Those are the type of events back in time that are in the low $100 million events that we also assess if due to inflation and other changes have met our threshold.
Okay.
But to answer your bigger question, these extremes account for a vast majority of the total cost. Basically, the more extreme an event is, the more the distribution it takes up.
Okay, operator, I think we're going to jump to the phone line. So can you queue up the first question from the line? Thank you.
Yes, one moment. Our first question comes from Seth Brodersen. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you for doing this. I actually have two, one for Adam and one for Jake or Deke or whoever of the two of you want to do that one. For Adam, the $306 billion, I know you're only looking at billion-dollar disasters and only looking since 1980. There were a lot of weather disasters pre-1980, and something like Camille comes to mind. Is this $306 billion total? Obviously, it's the most expensive year of billion-dollar disasters. Is it fair to take that a step further and say, is it the most expensive weather year, or are there years that might have competed on there? And also, is there any way of just giving, not quantifying, but a general sense, like more than half of this, this increasing trend in billion-dollar disasters, more than half of it is development, population, non-climate, or more than half of it is climate-oriented? I mean, I'm just wondering, which of these two giant factors, if you put them in climate versus non-climate human stuff, is bigger?
To answer your first question, so the reason we began our analysis in 1980 is that's really the year that the public and private data sources are of the best quality. There is another publication, actually, the National Hurricane Center has had for many years. It goes back to 1900 and really seeks to answer the question you posed regarding how does this year, as far as the costliest hurricanes, compare to previous hurricane years, such as those before 1980. And certainly we had large years before 1980, but our analysis strictly looks at the 1980 to 2017 period. Dee, would you like to take the second?
Yes, Seth, we really do not. This is Dee Garnt, by the way. We, again, for the purposes, especially of relatively quick turnaround like this product, we do not try to parse those apart. We are really just more interested in quantifying what's going on. Both the economists and the physical scientists retrospectively will look at that, but those kind of happen at the speed of science rather than quick assessment.
Okay, and then for Jake or for you, Deke, just looking at this, obviously it's the same question we always have to ask, even if we know pretty much what you're going to say. With the rising, U.S. Contiguous U.S. temperatures, is it fair to say that is forced by human caused climate change? And can you explain to people why, if they're freezing out there today, it still can be on the heels of one of the hottest years ever? I know the answers, but I need you to say that.
So I'll jump in there. This is Deke. In the general picture, the warming U.S. over the long term, yes, it is related to larger scale warming that we've seen on the global scale. The U.S. will have a lot more kind of year-to-year variability, so the bounces up and down depending on prevailing weather regimes tend to be a little more dramatic on our country, which takes up about 2%, a little less than 2% of the planet. But the long-term signal, yes, is tied with long-term warming. And then as Jake pointed out, you know, we do live in a warming world, but we still have very cold poles, and we still have the same weather systems that pull cold air away from those poles into places where we live. And so at any given time, and I think Jake's first map really illustrates this beautifully, you know, we're still going to see blue blobs on the map. But when they average out with a lot of the pinks and reds that we see over the course of the year, we end up resulting with a pretty warm year. Those blue blobs are uncomfortably cold at times, especially during this time of year. But we still are looking at the average over the long term.
Thank you.
You bet, Seth.
Okay, next question from the phone, operator.
Our next question comes from Alexander Kaufman. Your line is open.
And Alexander, can you please indicate your organization as well? Thanks.
One moment, I apologize.
Damage and disaster that's still happening in California because of the wildfires.
Hey, Alexander, I think you were cut off. Can you start your question over? We didn't hear your entire thing.
Yeah, no problem. I was asking whether at what point the data used for this was cut off, you know, when considering things like the wildfires in California.
This is Adam. The question was, at what point was the data cut off when considering the wildfires, the cost of the wildfires in California? So we work with multiple data sources on this, the Property Claim Services, which is the insurance data source for gold standards, if you will, and also the National Interagency Fire Center. So we really monitor those all the way till the end of the year. That's one of the beauties about having this product come out the first or second week of January. But it's a good question because there is some data latency. There, for example, the acreage of wildfires right now exceed 9.8 million acres, but it's not implausible to say that final tally may exceed 10 billion acres, or I believe even the record, which is 10.1 million acres set just several years ago.
And are there any other disasters that are on slide four that's applicable to?
No, we believe slide four is pretty static as regarding the data, what we expect to come in.
Okay, thank you.
Next question, please.
Kim Miller, your line is open.
Post. So first thing, is there a place, maybe I'm missing it online, where I can look and see what the Florida expenses were, the disaster, climate disaster costs?
Yes, the question was where can one look online for specific state disaster costs. We actually have a relatively new feature on the $1 billion disaster website under mapping, and you can look at costs or frequency at the event level, at the state level. So that should be a useful resource for you.
Is there an address, website address?
Yes, the website address would be www.ncdc.noaa.gov/billions/mapping.
Mapping, okay. And then the other question was just we have now 2 years in a row of La Nina. How much did La Nina impact, you think, last year's temperatures?
This is Jake. It's hard to parse out how much one particular mode of climate variability had on the impacts of an annual temperature. With a La Nina, we do tend to see warmer than average conditions across the southern U.S., particularly during the cold parts of the year, and that was the case in 2017, particularly during the 2016-2017 winter. So even though those outcomes are consistent with what we would expect with a La Nina, it is hard to parse out the exact percentage that particular phenomenon had on the annual outcome.
Okay, thank you.
A next question, please.
Our next question comes from Mark Ifrin. Your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay, hey, this is Amir Irfan. I'm a reporter at Vox. Just curious about how you're actually building your estimates. I think Adam mentioned using the insurance database, but I'm wondering what else is there that's being tabulated, and then what are some of the uncertainties with respect to cost? And then the second part of that question is then also getting to the cutoffs for a situation like Puerto Rico, which is still in blackout. At what point do we cut off the estimate for 2017 or for like the ongoing fires in Southern California?
Hi, this is Adam. The question was what data sources, what methods do we use, how is uncertainty integrated into these estimates, and also what is the cutoff date for finalizing these estimates based on the ongoing information? So, indeed, we use a variety of the best public and private data sources. Those include the Property Claim Service, FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program, the USDA Crop Insurance Program, the National Interagency Fire Center, state and local emergency management agencies often do their reporting, providing deeper metadata. There are really about a dozen reports, and you're correct to state that the first line is understanding the exposure, the insured losses, and how much of the exposure is insured. And of course, this varies by peril. So hurricanes, the wind versus water question is often complicated for anyone to assess. Therefore, the uncertainties for a hurricane often are higher than what would be the case for a severe local storm or other more insured events. And the last part of the question regarding when we cut off, it's true, basically, the larger the event, the longer the data may take to fully materialize. We saw that with Hurricane Katrina back in 2005 when it was over 12 months after the event took place where data was still being finalized. We may see the same in Puerto Rico, given the level of destruction.
Cool. And if I could ask a quick follow-up question. We're using the numbers, I think, largely as a proxy here for human suffering, but to what extent do those diverge? I mean, to what extent does a billion-dollar estimate not fully reflect the full harm that is being wrought by some of these disasters?
The question was, to what extent do variables like human suffering, how are those integrated or not integrated into our analysis? Well, with the many data sources, we have, you know, a dozen different variables, but it's important to point out we do not take into account things like healthcare-related costs, the destruction of natural capital in those assets, also physical and mental distress. The, you know, economists can put costs on that. There's not enough consistent, solid data for us to use that in our framework. So it could be stated that these costs are the best of our ability, but they really are perhaps a low point to the true total costs that are hard to calculate.
Thank you.
Great. Operator, actually, I'm going to quick survey the folks in the audience. Any more questions or a follow-up question?
Yeah. Going to Life USA today, does the death and the amount include Puerto Rico?
Question was, this is Adam, the question was, do the death counts in court include Puerto Rico? So, great question. We basically are using the latest official toll, but as we know, there are a number of individuals, groups that are reassessing what the true toll may be. And indeed, when that comes through, particularly with the government of Puerto Rico doing their own assessment, we will update the number when that number is available, which could be substantially higher. Mm-hmm.
Any more questions here? I'll jump back to the phone. Operator, can you queue up the next call on the phone?
Our next question comes from Steve Barragona, Voice of America. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for doing the call. I think you've pretty much answered the question, but I guess you mentioned the overall warming trend that you see nationwide being part of climate change. Are there other parts of this report, the other disasters or the other trends that you can link, the precipitation or droughts or anything else that we can say is part of the overall warming trend?
Hey, Steve, this is Dee. So again, from a year to year, we don't try to make that assessment, but what we do know from established science that particularly an increase in big heat waves, their duration, their intensity, their frequency is going up. So that's clearly related to an increase in heat-related disasters that we've seen. We know that over the long term, big rain is getting bigger. So the intensity of really big, unusually large rainfall events, and that is related somewhat to the increase in the flooding disasters that we've seen. But with the big caveat that we are not trying to parse those signals out, and in particularly in any given year, much of this comes down to what kind of hazard struck what kinds of assets at what and how valuable those were. It's really pulling back into the long-term decade over decade signal where you can really kind of get a good idea of trends and how climate may influence them. But those are probably the two that have the clearest signal in the physical science world.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Next question comes from Brian Kahn from Earther. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for my question. I just wanted to clarify, you're looking at what the billion-dollar losses, we're talking about losses. Is there any sense of, I guess I'm curious to know if your calculations include any of the costs from battling wildfires or other things like, you know, hurricane relief? Or, you know, if they don't, how would those things sort of factor into, you know, I guess your perception of this you know, disasters in 2017.
Hi, this is Adam. The question was, do we take into account things like wildfire suppression costs or disaster relief costs into our analysis, and how does that affect our assessment in perspective of 2017? Indeed, we do take into account both of those variables. In addition to the physical damage that happened in, particularly in California in 2017, also the wildfire costs are some of the highest on record. And you can link that back to the scale of the wildfires approaching 10 million acres in 2017. Also, certainly we take into account you know, the variables for on-the-ground relief and how that accounts. That's a relative small variable in the scheme of things, but no matter how you cut 2017, it was very historic and perhaps even unprecedented in some ways.
Thanks.
All right, operator, next question.
And again, just as a reminder, to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Joshua Spicer from American Geophysical Union. Your line is open.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Josh from the American Geophysical Union. I was hoping you could elaborate on the role of the GOES satellite in making these predictions and the economic impact over the past year and satellite data in general.
Hi there, this is Deke. Thank you very much. So satellite information is increasingly important as in climate assessment. While the particular data sets don't draw directly upon the satellite information, it was vital in the warnings and the watches and advisories that came out related to these events, particularly the severe weather and the hurricane events. So it really plays a role perhaps in mitigating the cost and maybe some of those human losses that were mentioned earlier on the call. And it is becoming an increasingly important data stream in climate studies as well. But, you know, the value realized was realized most immediately by the operational meteorology community, and I think that's where its biggest impact has been so far.
And this is Brady. Just to add to that, you know, since the launch of and since GOES 16 was last year, the first particularly hurricane season, also the active wildfire season, where we had these new Earth-observing instruments in place and provided amazing imagery to actually view these as they were unfolding, which not only, you know, helped inform forecasting, and now that they're operational, we look forward to them being online and directly contributing to the operational forecast. But also, it did provide an unparalleled avenue for folks to really view these unfolding, and the quality and types of images and visualizations that came from that are pretty stunning. And when you looked at things, you know, whether tracking the hurricanes or even nighttime images of Puerto Rico before, during, and after the storm, you know, people did use that to assess, you know, where was the power on or not. And so I think these are new tools at our disposal that everybody's now incorporating into how they can better use these products in the future. Next question. Oh, sorry, did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you so much.
Yep. Next question, please.
Seth Broderstein, your line is open.
It's Seth Bornstein at the Associated Press again. Thank you. For the silly not silly, but, you know, one of these horrible detailed questions, the figures for 2017 for the year, that's for the lower 48 for CONUS, right? I know because records go back to 1895. Is there any way to say whether when you throw in Alaska, which, as you said, was really hot, Hawaii was, like every other state, warmer than normal, is there any way to figure out where we are for all 50 states as a total, you know, in terms of third or whatever? I mean, does that change it either up or down?
Hi, Seth. This is Deke. So Alaska and Hawaii have very unique observing histories, just like they have very unique histories in general in relation to the 48 states. The Alaskan data, and particularly the Hawaiian data, does not date back nearly as far. We cannot, with the same level of confidence, assess those, especially trying to compare them apples to apples. We have looked into it a few times, and we've decided it's really, for the time being, better to treat them as their own historical records, because they have different born-on dates and different challenges in how we kind of aggregate the information across those very different geographies.
Okay, and then, given on the same topic, the press release talks about for the third consecutive year, every state across the contiguous U.S. and Alaska had above-average annual temps. So that sort of leaves the question of Hawaii. And when I looked it up, it looks like Hawaii also for the last 3 or 4 years have been above normal. Is there a reason why it's worded that way? I mean, why can't we just say every state for the last three consecutive years has been above average for annual temperature?
So it is likely true, but we do not compute an official statewide temperature for Hawaii, so we do not include it into the statistics that we report.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Seth.
Next question, please.
Kim Miller from Palm Beach Post. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for taking my third question, I guess, now. To get across to readers the significance of 2017 being so warm, I think last year you guys talked about the breadth. It wasn't just that there was it was, you know, so warm, but it was the breadth across every state that had warmth. Is that a situation this year also?
Hi, this is Jake. Yes. So in 2017, every state in the lower 48 had an average temperature that was above average, and this is the third consecutive year that has been the case. So it's a continuation of what we've seen in 2016, what we saw in 2015, and we also saw a similar situation in 2012. So the warmth in 2017 for the lower 48 really was observed from coast to coast.
Okay. Is there a way to get across what the significance of that is? I fear readers get here, you know, third warmest or top five warmest again and kind of turn that off. How can we convey how important it is?
I think it's important. So the contiguous U.S. is a big place. So and weather and climate patterns that can influence outcomes on monthly, seasonal, and annual scales are very depend on which region you're in. So just the fact that every state, you know, averaged across the 365 days of the year had above average temperature is significant. I think it is important to note that there were numerous states that had their warmest year on record. So if you're living in Arizona or New Mexico or Georgia or South Carolina or North Carolina, where you live, it was the warmest it has ever been in our period of record in those locations. So I think it's important to note that, you know, even though we say third warmest, there were locations that were record-setting in 2017.
Thank you.
And then I'm going to go back to the audience. Any further follow-up questions? And if not, I'll put out the last call for those of you on the phone. Operator, can you just do one last reminder as to... I was going to say press star, but I didn't want to mess it up. So could you remind folks how to ask a question?
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Please stand by for those questions to come through.
Okay, and if not, I will begin by concluding and wrapping up this call. Again, thank you to all of our speakers, some of which are live here in Austin. And Jake, sorry that you're back in the ice in Asheville, but maybe next year. And also thank you for the reporters for joining in the call, not only this, but for our monthly climate call. I think this has been a valuable service, and it's been enjoyable working with all of you in helping build your stories about what's happening around the country. A couple final reminders for some upcoming releases. Many of you have asked me about when NOAA is releasing our 2017 global temperature record. Both NOAA and NASA are planning a separate or a joint media call on January 18th, where we'll both respectively announce our temperature records for the date. A separate media advisory will be sent out for that call. And also, if you're now that we're in the new year, our next U.S. climate highlights will be released on February 7th, and then the global for January will be released February 20th. So this concludes the call. As a final reminder, an audio of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov media advisory within about 60 minutes or so. And if you do have further information needs, please email me at brady.phillips@noaa.gov. And my contact information is available on the top of the media advisory. Again, thank you all, and this concludes the call. Bye-bye.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.